Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we're talking Kurdish issues. As always, I'm joined by my co-host and a man who actually looks like he's been in the Russian winter. Martin, it's not that cold.
Yeah, well, it's this time of year, you got to put on your coat. Listen, folks, we have our live show coming up 22nd of this month. Tickets are available on our website. You can also get a discount there if you join up to become a patron. It'll be in the Wiley Fox on the 22nd, 6:30. Tickets are selling fast, so get yours. Thanks very much.
Much more importantly, we're delighted to be rejoined for the second time in a tortoise shack by ex-British Army and ex-member of the YPG fighting with the Kurdish forces against ISIS, former Iraqi prison cell inhabitant, I'm going to say, Josh, and student in international relations now. Joshua Malloy. Josh, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Look, Can we start off and just go quite broad on this? The last week, what is your sense of what actually has happened?
It's just total chaos. Everything has just collapsed. I don't even know where to begin. So much has happened. It's not just about the invasion or the betrayal of allies. It's or even the ISIS security situation. This is like, for me, it feels like this is just unprecedented. I can't really think of anything else that compares to this ever happening before.
And you used the word betrayal there. And it must feel to the Kurdish people who have fought as allies with Western forces that yet again, they've been betrayed. That's not too strong at all, really.
No. And those are the words they use when they were told by the Americans that they were going to withdraw. They said, you've sold us, you've betrayed us. And even though they kind of knew this was going to happen, it's not the first time the Kurds have been betrayed by America. There was this hope that because America was able to pursue its own interests by defeating ISIS and bringing stability to the region, and at the same time support, you know, the democratic ideals that they pledged to promote at the same time. And they have these two objectives kind of align with one another. There was this feeling that the Americans would kind of, you know, stick it through to the end, at least to the negotiations, and get something across the line, some kind of deal.
Yeah. Well, instead of what actually happened was President Trump just overnight basically issued an order. And that was effectively giving Erdogan, president of Turkey, the license to start what he's calling an operation, and many other people are calling an assault and an invasion.
Yeah.
Just to put this in context, it is a very difficult part of the world to, you know, it's not black or white. It's not simply this was. These forces good, that force bad, and these, you know, good actors and bad actors. And there were alliances made, you know, between people who had the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And, you know, and now what we're seeing is these old enmities coming to the surface and being allowed to fester, because the Turks, for one point, they will say that they look upon those forces, they'll say they're terrorist organizations. You fought with them. Can you give us your perspective of first of all, who they are and why, you know, they brought, how they managed to bring stability to that area?
Okay. So originally the partnership between the Americans and the YPG, took place in Kobani in 2014. The Americans supported the YPG with airstrikes and the city was besieged. Over time, as the relationship grew, in a way to appease Turkey, who were concerned about YPG and their links to the PKK, and also to have a plan for stable governance in the areas freed from ISIS. They developed the Syrian Democratic Forces, which was an alliance between the YPG and Arab fighters, as well as Syrian Christians, the small amount of Syrian Christians that were still there. So it was a multi-ethnic coalition, and Arab towns and Arab villages were governed by people that they elected through the form of local councils. So it's not even a case of Kurdish dominance or these are all Kurds. It's, you know, in fact, I'm not even sure what the actual numbers are right now, but I mean, there's a significant number of Arabs. It isn't just like a token, several thousand. So it's not just even, you know, just the Kurds. It's the whole region, and it was stable. It was self-governing. And Turkey wants to send these refugees back into Syria. So they want to create this so-called safe zone. Even though it doesn't look like much, it's a 20-mile strip along the border. All of the major towns are there, all the major cities, the Kurdish-held cities, so Kobani, Tel Abyad, Sardakani, and Derik and Komishlo, all of these cities will fall under that 20-mile zone, which will push Kurds south into the desert. There's a few towns and there's a few cities around there, but there's nothing, not enough significant infrastructure to take those people.
And it's destabilizing. I mean, that's not going to stop with the 20-mile zone. This is the bigger, the macro picture is that it's going to destabilize the region again.
Yeah.
And that you're reintroducing fighters you had taken out of the picture. You had, you had, I'm not saying anybody put down their arms, but you had these really tentative alliances that were something to build upon. I mean, you have a Christian militia that's allied with a Muslim militia to fight ISIS. I mean, that's unheard of. And now you're putting all that in jeopardy. Now all that's, those threads are all pulling really tight.
Yeah.
As Tony said, it's very hard to see. It's not a black and white. This isn't a John Wayne movie. This is very complex. A lot of moving parts. And Turkey, as well as being a nation on itself, it's a member of NATO.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, NATO is doing this. You know, this is a member of NATO. It's up to NATO to say, stop. And now I know the French have said, oh, we won't sell. We'll put an embargo on, or not even an embargo. We'll suspend arms sales. Well, that's great. You've sold all the arms. This is what's kicking this off. You know, you should have done that 3 years ago, 4 years ago.
Yeah.
What about the region? From your studies now, you see a bigger macro picture. What about the region? What way is the region heading?
This is the thing. It's so unpredictable. I mean, even now, like just in the last few days, so much has happened. Like in the last hour, just before I got here, I saw, even though it's not verified at the moment, that as many as 785 ISIS prisoners could have escaped. And on the day of the invasion, there was ISIS cells had carried out an attacks in Raqqa. There was car bombing in Komishlo. There was another car bombing in Hasakeh. So we're seeing these ISIS cells reactivate and become reemerge on the scene to exploit the chaos. So I think in terms of what's going to happen in the region, I think I don't think it'd be crazy to say we could see, you know, and a significant Islamic State insurgency. Well, I don't think they'll control territory like they did before, but I think it will be.
There was a push to take Raqqa, wasn't there? They did, you know, a knee-jerk reaction to try and take Raqqa, and they hit a few of the key places.
Yeah.
But the Kurds fought back and pushed them back out again.
Yeah.
But for a couple of hours there, that was on a knife edge.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, if the Kurds have to push north to face off this invasion, it's not just the camps they'll be leaving. They'll be leaving territory in the south. And even though a lot of this, you know, the checkpoints are manned by like Arab men and women and locals, whether they'll be able to hold the city themselves, we don't know. And then you have the regime pushing from the south is probably going to carry out some kind of land grab and try and retake some territory. So they'll be kind of caught in the middle. Where, you know, there's nothing really there.
About three times we've heard the phrase now already, land grab. So, to put it in historical context, there's, you know, they say that the Kurdish people are the largest ethnic type people that don't have a homeland.
Yeah.
And they've had kind of semi-autonomous regions, whether it was under Saddam Hussein, they were kind of given, okay, they were treated abominably, but there was also a semi-autonomous region. And then there was parts of Turkey, and there are huge, is it 20 million people who identify as ethnic Kurdish? Could be wrong, but anyway, it is a large number of people. And Turkey will say, well, actually, this is a land grab by them. But I suppose that the pushback on that is they were the people who did fight, force ISIS. Like, ISIS was controlling a mass
amount of land, munitions, oil. I mean, they were self-funding.
Yeah.
I mean, they were able to sell their oil. They were able to keep the money rolling in, keep buying weapons. And that was largely neutered. It was largely cut off. But now it's, you're back in that same game again.
Yeah. It's, I remember when I first got there, that was the ambitions of the YPG were to just liberate Rojava. And if you look at like Rojava on a map, it's a lot smaller than the territory that they actually control now. And they had no intentions to go south to Raqqa or any of these other Arab cities. It was just Rojava that they wanted. And that was just from talking to the guys on the ground. But that changed very quickly when the Americans needed a viable option to counter the Islamic State on the ground in Syria. They had partners they could work with on the ground in Iraq, but in Syria it was a completely different story. They tried supporting rebels and that didn't work due to, you know, there were some radical elements there. There was they had to have a very strict vetting program. It didn't really go anywhere. It was so much money is pumped in just to train and arm a small amount of people that ended up defecting, being killed or captured very quickly. And it just kind of turned into a disaster. So the YPG, the Kurds were well organized. They had experience and they were just, in terms of partnership, I've even heard the Middle East Institute referred to this as the most successful non-conventional military operation in history. The partnership between the Kurds and the Americans, you know, it was a lot of it wasn't just to do with pragmatism or realpolitik. It was about the attitude of the Kurds, spirit of them, and their willingness to and openness to working with other partners and the way that they could convince other people in the region to work alongside them. Everything just worked perfectly. And it was like, if you look at the disasters in Iraq and Afghanistan and the failures that American foreign policy had in influencing the outcomes they wanted to influence, and you look at Rojava, what they did in northern Syria, this is something that worked well, not just in terms of the pursuit of their interests. They were able to influence the outcomes. They were able to, you know, cobble together a force, use maximum air power as a strategy and to retrieve all this territory. But they are also able to work alongside partners that believed in a form of democracy. Not the same as like Western liberal democracy, but in a way that's kind of tailor-made for the region.
Can you see any rationale behind what Trump has done? Can you see why? Are you just at a total loss of why he's done this?
It baffles me because everyone told him, don't do this. You know, it's the whole world, every analyst, every researcher, every journalist, you know, activist, heads of state, you know, the amount of people that
and
have come
out. And his own foreign affairs have told him,
yeah,
you know, you can't do this. But he has done it, and it's done. It's a fait accompli. Mm. And how do you rein Turkey back in now? You can't.
No, because once they take Tal Abyad and Serikani and they dig themselves in, it's going to be very hard to say, okay, we want you to walk back towards the border. Yeah. No, we want you to listen.
Yeah, there's no walking this back. There is no walking this back.
And I just don't. The only thing I can see, diplomacy doesn't seem to be working. There seems to be no mechanisms in place that can actually hold Turkey to account and reverse this. The only thing I can see is perhaps YPG or Syrian Democratic Forces. They put up a resistance that's so fierce it slows it down long enough for
administration change in the US.
Or Russia and Assad. I think those are the only two.
They're the players, yeah.
Yeah.
Just on the, and I mean, we talk about that and we say about pushback, that means people are going to die.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. I mean, that is the reality of this, and people are dying today, you know. And these are, I'm right in saying that President Erdogan said that if the EU got involved, he'd simply open his borders and push refugees because effectively, we talk about Fortress Europe a lot, and it's not something that we don't really, you know, it's hard for us to ascertain. But we've been outsourcing a refugee issue to Turkey, so the EU has not been carrying out in good faith either. It's a bad actor when it comes to this. Do you think that is actually going to stymie any response from the EU itself?
I don't know. It's tough to tell. I know he's used this before. He's tried to weaponize the refugees, and it's not the first time he's talked about sending them all to Europe. Whether he actually will or not, I don't know.
But he's definitely weaponizing them by sending them back into Syria. That's weaponizing refugees.
This is ethnic cleansing is basically what he's doing. He's replacing the population. Of course, is a credible concern. You have, you know, millions of refugees in your country. You want to send them back. Of course, that is. But you don't go and invade
them. Send them back into a region that's stable enough for them to go back into.
Yeah.
You don't destabilize the region and then say, off you go. That's just madness.
And, like, that's the thing. You use, like, maximum air power and bombardment. Civilians are going to flee. This is what happened in Afrin. People fled the city. And they're also afraid of what's going to happen when these, you know, the Syrian National Army is the name of the militia, Turkish-backed Free Syrian Army guys. They're also afraid of what's going to happen when these guys come in. They're going to extort, loot, kill, rob, and then there'll be infighting among the various different factions as there was in Afrin. So it's chaotic, and you can see the civilian population would obviously want to avoid that and will obviously want to flee. And then you have these empty cities, and they'll literally just move into houses. That's the way it works over there. It's like they just move into houses. I've seen it before, people just stealing houses. They just go in with their blankets and mattresses and move in, and that's it. It's there. And that's what's going to happen. It's just going to be a replacement of
Set of refugees for another set of refugees.
Yeah, pretty much in the north of the country. And that's going to lead to a lot of instability
across the entire country.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Assad does stand to gain here.
Yeah. It's,
I mean, he's been relatively useless as a ruler of Syria. You know, he's a ruler. He had a title of ruler of this, but this now weakens the people who he had no success pushing back against. It creates trouble if we have some sort of resurgence of ISIS, which we more than likely will, because we've now given, as you said, there's reports of releasing ISIS prisoners getting out of jail. And if these people come out of jail, I don't think they're going to suddenly decide that, let's never do anything ever again. And Assad has effectively, through Russia, has waited it out, and now he's going to probably do some awful stuff, potentially.
Yeah.
I would find that terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, he's in the really good position now, and the SDF, they have no, they have no leverage here. They're in a desperate situation. So they're likely to be in a very weak position in any kind of negotiation. So Assad does stand to do very well.
It's really hard to know what's in it for the Americans. They stabilized a very unstable situation, right or wrongly, whatever the tactics were. You had a region that was very unstable, that just getting there. But now it's just a tinderbox, just trying to match in there. And you're wondering, how does this benefit America? For all intents and purposes, ISIS was over. As far as the Americans were considered. Now it's not. Now you've just reignited the whole thing. And there's kind of a big why.
Why
would you?
Yeah. It's absolutely baffling. You had all these prison camps full of people. They still needed to be dealt with, and no one wanted to do anything. There was obviously people always very, they quick say, ISIS isn't defeated and all of this, but it's like the physical space, the territory was taken from them. Then they weren't able to govern space anymore. And that's important. Of course, they're going to pose a long-term threat to stability still. But by doing this, you're really, really accelerating that. And ISIS has taken advantage of it so quickly. I mean, it goes to show how well organized they were.
Within hours, they moved. Within hours.
All of these networks. They were just energized very quickly by this, and they were able to exploit it and carry out a mission-specific wave of insurgency. This wasn't just, a steady bombing campaign. This was Turkey's invading,
They went for where the seats of power and broadcast was. That's what they went for. They were the two places they went straight away, was to get broadcast and get the seat of power. I mean, that's revolutionary stuff. That's what you do in any revolution.
I've heard people say that some people say this was a serious attempt to take the city. They did do things like this before. they would carry out these crazy counterattacks that would be almost baffling, like, you know, sending guys in to try and take, you know, an entire city. But it was, they exploit chaos so well. I mean, the thing about ISIS is when they were kind of, even if you look at the old caliphate on a map, it was like an octopus with all of these tentacles, and they were like very hypersensitive to all of the, you know, the geopolitical fault lines, the, you know, the fractures along ethnic lines, the history, the cultural context, and they were able to exploit that and get their enemies to fight each other. So as an actor in international relations, ISIS has been strategically brilliant. It hasn't, there's been a method to the madness. Even if you look, the best example I think of was what they did in southeast of Turkey in 2015, carried out suicide bombings against the Kurds. The PKK in Turkey had been in a ceasefire for a couple of years at that point, and this kind of exacerbated tensions, and they were able to exploit that, and the PKK and Turkey got into a renewed conflict with one another. I mean, everything about that was strategically, it was brilliant what they were doing, and they knew that that would tie up resources with the YPG who they were fighting. So they're very, very smart.
People forget that one of the ISIS things, you know, you talk about them being culturally and historically aware. And then they drove it was like a Caterpillar JCB across a no man's land and said we're ripping down the Sykes-Picot border. You know, it's, you know, that stuff that, you know, while we were having our rising in Easter 1916, there was people sitting down and drawing these maps and these lines across this, and ISIS were saying they were drawn by the French and the Brits, and we're saying, you know, this is us reascending. So yeah, I can see why that's terrifying. Also terrifying to know that al-Baghdadi and al-Zahari and all of these people are still on the, if you're going to use that phraseology, they're still on the board. The pieces are still on the board. They're still running things.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, and it, if you leave a vacuum, thing is going to, it's going to rush into it very quickly.
I think, yeah, the analogy that it's a board game, it's kind of a chessboard, and you were actually one move away from checkmate, and
it
knocked all the pieces off the board.
That's probably the best analogy I can think of. You know, I mean, it was, he had a strategy that was working, he was winning, and then all of a sudden he just walked away from a game he was winning. And
just the pigeon thing, just jumped on the board and knocked all the pieces over.
And his logic has been that he wants to put a stop to these endless wars, and this was a way to stop war. I mean, all he had to do was just have 50 or so guys there. All they had to do was just be there.
A presence, yeah.
Yeah, and he pulled them back, and that has started a war. That he will, at some point further down the line, whether it's in a week or a month or maybe even 10, 15, 20 years' time, the United States will have to engage with the region again because, you know, they'll have no choice.
Well, they had pushed a lot of their self-perceived attack on America, the terrorists, they had pushed a lot of that back over to the region.
Yeah.
And it had become less of an issue within the states itself. You know, it had stopped being, you know, they'd gone from, I suppose the extremists have gone from hating Muslims to hating Mexicans. And, you know, Muslims were beginning to fade into the background. It was beginning, but now it's going to come front and center again. You've literally just let these people go. Yeah. And these are really well-trained insurgents who know what they're doing. I mean, the problem was that the experience was in jail and all they had left were the young guys coming through without the experience. Now you've just sent the experience back.
Yeah, yeah.
You've just sent it back. You've sent your trainers, you've sent your recruiters, you've sent everything back. What is going to happen except that it's going to explode again?
Yeah. I mean, these are expert bomb makers. You know, you have people very, you know, very, very combat hardened. Like some of these would have fought in Raqqa. Manbij, you know, they would have had a lot of combat experience, and they would have come back, and they've, you know, they stayed there to the dying days.
They held Deir ez-Zor, I'm saying that wrong, for 3.5 years.
Yeah, the fighting there was quite brutal, because a lot of these guys who had all this combat had been kind of pushed and pushed and pushed. I mean, that was part of the whole strategy. Realistically, America could have gone in with a shock and awe tactic like in Iraq, and just invaded the whole space. But then these people would have scattered. You know, it's like breaking a rock with a hammer. It just goes into smaller pieces. But with the strategy that they were pursuing with the SDF, it was a chunk by chunk strategy where they were purposely, you know, cutting it chunk by chunk at a time, using maximum air power and using these kind of local forces as boots on the ground to cover the space and to push forward into it, hold it, and hold the territory, and then govern the space behind it. And this is what happened. It was chunk by chunk until it was a tiny little village in the middle of nowhere that no one's ever heard of, and they made their last stand. And it worked. Worked very well. But it's, yeah, it just seems like all of that work is being completely undone now.
Because but the Kurds have enemies on all sides, and that's the problem for the Kurds. They have enemies with Syria, they have enemies with the Russians, and now they have enemies in America. Like, the Kurds didn't make an alliance with the Yanks thinking the Yanks are stand-up guys and you know, we can realize. They've always known.
Well, remember, it was the first Gulf War where they dropped leaflets and things under the first George Bush and said to the Kurdish people, rise up and America will come to defend you. That is, these are a matter of fact. And a couple of weeks later, once they liberated Kuwait, they just went, oh, should we do something about the Kurds? And they were left to their own. And when Saddam regrouped, he cracked down something terrible. I mean, you know,
To be a terrible situation that you can trust absolutely nobody. Absolutely nobody. And it's degrees of who's going to betray you worst.
Yeah. I mean, the Kurds have an expression, no friends but the mountains. And the mountains has always been a place that they can rely on. It's the actual geography itself. It's the space itself that they can be, you know, these kind of ungoverned places where you're free from your enemies and you can wage insurgency and all the rest of it. And that's, you know, that's long been an expression that's resurfaced time and time again because of these situations in the past. But the problem with Rojava is there's no mountains there. It's a very flat landscape. And, you know, to wage an insurgency there,
it's hard to defend.
Yeah, it's very, very difficult to defend. And, you know, it's where they're going to run to. They're going to be kind of caught in the middle between these two enemies unless they make a deal. And the last thing I did see was Maslam Kobani, the head of the SDF at the moment. He's talking about making a deal with the Russians and the regime. And he's asking the Americans, you know, I need to know whether you're willing to help me. You know, we're getting slaughtered out here. I need to know, because if you're not, then I'm going to have to ask you to leave and then ask the Russians to come in and help us. So they're kind of forced into this position right now.
Yeah. And have you any sense what way the Yanks are going to leap on this one?
Well, he's also reached out to the UK and he's also reached out to the France, which shows, again, like I said before, the similar values and interests. He would rather work with the West. He doesn't want to be in that position. Everyone knew that he would have to talk to Assad at some point in order to negotiate some kind of, you know, a deal for autonomy, not even independence, just autonomy. And they might have to give up territory in return for that and all this stuff. They always knew that at some point at the end of the line, they'd have to talk to the regime. But I think the hope was they would have some leverage with American presence there.
Or from position of strength rather than from position of weakness.
Yeah. And some safety and security, like a safety net to take them to that table.
There was, I'm right in saying, obviously, you know, we talk about this conflict has raged for decades, okay? It's not as simple. I know ISIS was a new manifestation of it, but, and Assad's crimes were begotten by his father's crimes and, you know, and the big players, as you said, Russia and America, who've played out this for since the Cold War via different vehicles and different proxy nations and proxy armies. But it's also, you know, we're talking about Trump and saying how he made this decision. We also remember that Obama made the red line phrase and then did nothing in effect. And again, into that vacuum, more people died. And, you know, these defense forces that, you know, there's some of them now, I think people have said to me that they're already, you know, saying, well, I was a member of this particular three-letter acronym, and not that three-letter acronym, and there's a bit of badge swapping going on for self-preservation, which I suppose is natural enough. Right, but do we need, unfortunately, do we need to accept that that it's maybe Russia are going to be the peacemaker here?
Well, from talking from the Kurds on the ground, they didn't like Russia. You know, they're very supportive of America, even though they've been burned by America before. And even though you have cases like Iraq and Afghanistan and this red line statement that Obama made, it's clear that US foreign policy hasn't always been the best. But I think the feeling was that this was something that was going so well And it suited America and it suited the people on the ground, and everything about this was right. Mm. It was, they were on the good side. They were on the right side. They were doing something that works. And the feeling was that they wouldn't walk away from that because that would be insanity. And that's exactly what they've done. So
now Trump is, I mean, it's not just one view coming from the States. Trump is under pressure to reverse this decision. Yeah. Do you think there's any juice in that? Do you think anything can happen there?
I really hope so. He did put out a tweet that was quite erratic.
I was surprised, come on.
Yeah, it was something along the lines of, in my
great and my unmatched wisdom.
Yeah, that was the one.
That was incredible.
And he didn't specify what actions Turkey could do that would be going over a certain line for him in that tweet. But I think, like, if we've seen so much now, you have to kind of question, well, where is that line?
Well, there's already, like, and I think, you know, they're shelling positions, they're shelling. You only have to turn on the news and you can see smoke rising from these towns and villages. And then you also know, you've talked about these prison camps. Like, to bring it back to domestic issues, you know, Lisa Smith is an Irish citizen with children there, and we've known for months now, and we were supposed to, you know, realistically, the argument that this nonsense that was rolled out, in my opinion, of leave her there, she should have been repatriated, and if she had to face justice for her actions. Now, it seems to me almost a convenience that this is going on, because we're hearing very little from the Irish government in terms of what's actually happened over the last week.
Yeah, in my opinion, they should all be coming back. And I say that even as someone who's fought against them and who's lost friends against them, like many friends, I think they should be returned back. That's mainly for practical reasons. There shouldn't be a burden to the SDF. And even though the Irish don't have that many members in the camp as compared to, say, France or Britain or whoever else, purely as a symbolic gesture as a Western European country to take their citizens back, especially at a time when no one else would, you know, it could have been a very significant move, and it could have got the cogs turning in the machine, and then Germany would have been next, and then Italy or France. You never know.
But it was who was going to be first to move, and nobody wanted to be first to move.
That's almost what it felt like. And people have taken back children and some women, but I mean, we're talking about, like, even just the you know, the guys who we know were combat troops there. And obviously there's difficulties in prosecuting them and everything, but it's like, you know, at some point we have to draw a line. These people were very, you know, ISIS were very emotionally engaging because they were so barbaric and brutal and horrifying that it's easy for us to draw a line and say, well, actually leave them over there, and we kind of turn it back on our own values and our own way of life and the structures that we live in, to abandon these people in a moment of, like, frivolous emotional kind of reaction to it.
And now Lisa Smith is in the wind. She's in the wind. Nobody knows.
Potentially, anyway, yeah.
She could be. And I mean, obviously here in the West, like, we do have a fixation on, say, the Western foreign fighters because we can relate to them. But they're really, I wouldn't say go as far as say they're a drop in the ocean. I'd say that they're relatively, you know, they make up, you know, a percentage of the fighters there. But the reality is, it's the Iraqi and the Syrian ISIS members who are, you know, it's the local grievances that people had that allowed for ISIS to exist, for this caliphate to develop, and for all these people to have something to rush forward to, is the bigger picture. In my opinion, as for people, like, as for Lisa Smith posing a threat to the West or any of these other groups, it's obviously a possibility, but I think the main concern for me would be on the ground. I mean, literally just before I got here, it's unverified now, but there's reports that ISIS flags have been seen on the M4 highway between Ras Al Ain and Tel Tamer. And Tel Tamer was the first front line I went to. And that's crazy to me to think that after all of that and everything,
there's an ISIS flag there.
Potentially. And obviously, it's just a flag. It's just a piece of cloth and stick. It doesn't, you know, there's no evidence that there's a checkpoint or there's any governance of territory. We don't know. And a lot of this could be rumours in the fog of war as well. But to me, it just shows just complete and utter disaster. You had something that worked so well. Like, we used to sleep on these blankets with AC-130 Spectre gunships in the air above us and jets roaring above us. All this American air power. You know, this huge machine of war and diplomacy in the skies above us. And, you know, this kind of naive kind of idealism of these young revolutionary fighters that we were with all on the ground. And, you know, we had so many internationals there. And you think about the size of that and the sheer scale of that and the enormity of it. And then you think of what's just happened now. It's just like a complete disaster. It's like, what were all of those years for? You know, what were all those bombs dropped for? You just literally, you know, all the money that was pumped into this, all of the effort, the work, it's all just like, just evaporated.
And the lives.
Yeah, the lives.
You know, I mean, like, you've lost friends and you've also known people who fought alongside you who've returned to other European nations who have had their lives put on pause, as a polite way of putting some of it. You know, when you look at those things, and then you, and we have this argument, and then, you know, people want to then focus on something as, and I fell into the trap myself, something as small as Lisa Smith in a way, you know, in the grander scheme of things. I do agree they should be repatriated, they should be charged with whatever we can charge them with, and face justice in whatever means we can. But we're not going to, if we lose our values, we lose who we are. And, you know, realistically, by not helping or not raising our voices, we're already tacitly.
I have to agree with you there, Josh. On the medium to long term, how do you see this developing? Are we looking at a very quick war? Are we looking at the Kurds being able to hold out for any length of time?
Well, this is something, when the city of Afrin fell in 2018, I sent a message to a friend who was around, and I asked him if it was true that the city had fallen, because I had read reports about it. And the words he used when he told me about it was, "We are the shards of glass that they have just swallowed," meaning this was going to be an insurgency that was going to go on for a long time. Of course, they've taken the city. Our flags are coming down. We're no longer walking around openly in uniform. And he was right. Within days, there was bombings and assassinations and attacks. So I could see the same thing happening in Serikani and Tel Aviv, especially, you know, because they've got such strong ties to the area. I can see something like that posing like a long-term insurgency. But as for the diplomacy and everything else, I think it's so unpredictable. And it's been so chaotic, and this whole disaster has been so multidimensional that it's hard to kind of assess which is the most critical layer. But I think if I was to give a guess right now, I think it's down to America stepping in and doing something, which doesn't look like it's going to happen, or a deal with Russia and the regime to try and create a no-fly zone. But at the same time, it could suit the Kurds. It could suit the regime in Russia very well to kind of screw them over.
And to draw back,
Shaft them and give them a really bad deal, and then just carve up, you know, the SDF-held territory between them and Turkey.
Because for the last while, Turkey and Russia have been at loggerheads, and now they have a mutual kind of interest in watching this, you know, standing, Russia sitting on their hands, and Turkey going ahead with what is, you know, as I said, they're calling an operation, and everybody's calling an invasion. You did keep talking about the need for diplomacy. There was I'm going to come back. You said, you know, when things are working perfectly, I would say perfectly imperfect to a degree, that things were functioning. There was the, you know, cities were running, towns were running, people were given positions, you know, there were town councils, there was local empowerment. The YPG and the Kurdish people were quite famous for being able to, you know, as you said, work with local communities and develop, get you know, get the bakeries reopened, get these things, the rudimentary things that people need for daily activities. That all ceases now. And my big fear is that without international action and proper calls for a cessation, there can't be diplomacy. And, you know, there won't be the, my other big fear then is that, again, is that sadly, the Kurdish people, again, will be the ones to suffer, more than any other demographic. Mm. I feel very pessimistic, Josh. Is there something that you can tell me that maybe I shouldn't be?
I think when it comes to their resistance, I mean, they put up such a fierce resistance in Kobani that it became symbolic for them. But that was against ISIS. That wasn't against an air force and, you know, a NATO army, the second largest NATO army in the world.
I mean, we can't say that enough. We cannot say it's the second largest NATO. I mean, you'd step back a little, say it again, second largest NATO army.
Our allies.
You know, and you just have to keep taking that step back and saying that because that's the leverage.
Yeah.
And that's the leverage.
It's the not only is it the second largest NATO army in the world, you know, it's run by a populist who's unpredictable. You know, who doesn't care. He's obviously hasn't been doing too well in elections recently. So he wants to boost them as well. So he's got so much to gain domestically.
That's kind of where I'm kind of at a loss. What has Trump got to gain domestically by doing this? I don't see his domestic gain by doing this. And, you know, if you take it out of the region and look at the implications for the rest of the world, what's in it for Trump?
They won't release the P tape, maybe.
Yeah,
allegedly.
Could be something like that. I mean, like, he said he wants to put a stop to these endless wars. At the same time, he's sending troops to Saudi Arabia now. And his justification is they're paying me. So I think the problem is he doesn't understand the benefits of staying in northeast Syria. Then he doesn't understand, but I've heard that apparently he's golfing right now.
Yes.
Recently, while this is all taking place. So I think it's not just a case he doesn't understand, he doesn't care, he doesn't see the implications of it. And maybe because he might even feel he's on the way out of the White House, I don't know. And he's just like, you know what, I'm just going to burn it. I don't know.
Burn it all down.
There's so many people trying to analyze and understand his foreign policy decisions, and no one can come up with any kind of theory or logic behind it.
There's no logic. When he's ignoring, you know, the advice of his own intelligence community, and has been since the get-go. So I heard, you know, there was a terrific one about Rex Tillerson working his whole life through Exxon Mobil, never had a political thing in his life. Was drilling for Russian oil and gas, and they couldn't get at it without Exxon. And then when Trump takes office, he's like, "Yo, by the way, here's your new foreign secretary who you've never met before and have no relationship with. Why?" And you're going, and people are now starting to go, "That didn't make any sense." And going, "Well, it kind of does when you think of the connections between I'm going to sound like Martin for once, but there's obviously Russian influence there at some level, and these things are, people are going to die. People are dying as we speak. And, you know, there has to be a way that at least a cessation of the operation or invasion.
Yeah.
You look devastated, Josh.
It's been very deflating. Especially because, like I said, it just feels like all of that it's not just being undone, it's being made worse. You know, I'm not like a Kurdish activist. I'm not, I'm not some, you know, you're just pro Kurdish person who's picked a side. You know, I'm just looking, even if you just stand back and look at this from a pragmatic and realistic kind of point of view, it just makes no sense to do this. And no one, you know, it's just absolutely baffling.
And you've been doing that since we last spoke to you. That's exactly what you've been doing. You've been standing back and taking a pragmatic view. You've been studying hard. How's it going?
Good. Yeah. I'm enjoying it. I'm distracted lately by what's happening, but other than that,
You've been putting a lot of work into your studies. A huge amount of work into your studies.
Yeah. So yeah, I'll see how it goes.
We hope the future for yourself is very successful. We really appreciate you coming back on to have a chat with us. I would say to the listeners, go back and listen to the first interview we did with Josh. He is a remarkable man who despite his soft-spoken stepped forward and actually did something that I know I haven't got the...
Well, I can, because I'm old enough, I can say this. He's a remarkable young man, and I can say that. Yeah. I'm allowed to say that. You're not. But no, and I think your studies, I think what you've gone into is just absolutely perfect. I think you couldn't have a better person who has the knowledge on the ground and then has the macro picture overall as well. I mean, that's what most security analysts are lacking is that personal experience.
There's some people might think I'm tainted because of my previous experience, so it's kind of a double-edged sword, but I'll see.
I think you can't beat hands-on experience. You just can't beat hands-on experience, and you have it in oodles. So I think you're going to be a great asset to the international security team that exists out there giving commentary. I think you're going to be a great asset to it. So thank you again for coming in and have a chat with us.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thanks for listening, folks. Martin's right. Head over to Patreon. You get 25% off the live event. Maybe throw us a couple of quid. Helps keep these shows coming. And we will post links to some of the events that are going on to raise awareness for the events that are taking place, the tragedy that is taking place right now. Talk to you all soon. Take care. Bye-bye.